Started. Hello. Welcome to the last session at TechEd. My name is Clemens Vasters. I'm an architect in the Microsoft Azure team, more specifically in the Azure IoT and Hyperscale group that owns Service Bus, owns Event Hubs, which I'm going to talk about today, and also owns all kinds of distributed systems goodness, which is powering the backend of Azure, and that over the next year or so, you will be seeing more of. But the innovation I'm going to talk about today is Event Hubs. Before I do that, though, thank you for being here. And thank you, actually, in the name of Microsoft, for coming out to Barcelona and listening to all the goodness that we have. So. Thank you for investing a week of your time into listening to all of the sessions here. It's very much appreciated. I want to talk about Service Bus, and I want to talk about capabilities that we have built into Service Bus, and kind of, for a moment, the evolution of Service Bus and where we came from and where we are going to, and that it's really a journey that we've been on. So Azure Service Bus is a capability that started as one of the first services that existed in Azure. We shipped in January 2010 with the rest of the platform. And we started out with the Relay. And the Relay is a capability that's still there. And it's we're actually going to talk about it more in the coming months because we think we have not talked about it enough. And we hear a ton of really cool scenarios that people are doing with it, even though we haven't beaten the drums yet. And that's one thing that we do not so well at Microsoft, arguably, is that once a product ships, then half a year later, nobody talks about it anymore because we always like to talk about the new thing. So we'll also want to talk a bit about the established things over the next months. I'm not going to do that today much. But in the nutshell, if you're not familiar with it, the Relay allows you to take a web service, today hosted with WebCF, but we have some tricks on our sleeves in the next coming months. And you can go and expose that through the firewall without having to set up a VPN or any of this. So you can have a web service that sits inside of your corporate data center, and you can expose a listener out. You can also expose a listener out from any environment, right, from a coffee shop, and make that publicly accessible. We create network magic to make those things accessible on Service Bus. So NAT and firewall traversal, request response services, unbuffered, and gives you TCP-like qualities. So that's number one. Number two is we have queues, we have topics, messaging, transactional. We have a transactional AMQP and HTTP-based cloud broker that is for enterprise messaging scenarios, super high scale, super high reliability, and we also have those features, queues, and topics available for you on the server. So there's Service Bus for Windows Server that you can download. It's part of the Windows license, Windows Server license, that you can install yourself, and it's an almost automatic magic five-way high availability cluster. Is one of the most robust messaging servers that you can actually get today, and it's part of your Windows license. The topics are for PubSub, publish subscribe pattern. You can make a topic, it's like a queue from the front, and from the back you can subscribe, and you have filtering capabilities on which messages you want to have, up to 2,000 subscriptions per topic, and these filter rules, you can have up to 2,000 of these rules on a subscription, or 100,000 rules even for the simpler ones. And then a more recent addition, also in the scope of Service Bus, we talk about this more as a separate service, but it's embedded in Service Bus, is called Notification Hubs. And Notification Hubs is kind of the first hyperscale capability that we have in the system. Allows you to send a message into a notification hub and push it out within very short time to millions of devices, and that is using the push notification services for Apple, for Android, so Google Cloud Messaging, for Windows Phone, and also for the Kindle. So all of these push notification services can be targeted with this, and we do multicast distribution. For instance, the official applications of the Olympic Games in Sochi were built on this, and we did all the multiplication and delivery of all the result events into all the mobile apps, all the push notifications. For that, Event Hub is the newest member of the family, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. And before I do this, I'm going to show you, I'm going to talk you through a number of examples of why that capability is interesting. We're going to start with intelligent mobility and connected car. Intelligent mobility is really about making our public transport infrastructure smarter. Right now, buses are guided based on very fixed lines. The schedule is very rigid. And sometimes you are in a bus and the bus just waits somewhere for several minutes because they were quicker where they were than scheduled because there was no traffic. And then at some other times, the bus is late because there was a lot of information. That is because there's not a lot of transparency about the routes. If there were more transparency around the routes, where are those buses currently? What is the traffic like? And if we could go and take the traffic information that comes out of the traffic lights and out of the loops that are in the street and could go and correlate that with information that comes out of the buses, we would have more transparency about the routes. We could make better predictions about when the bus is arriving and also reroute and do all kinds of optimizations around that traffic. One example. More interesting, that is very interesting. That's more a futurist thing because, of course, the public transportation will have to take a while to get there. More close to the present are connected car capabilities in passenger vehicles and also in commercial vehicles. And we see a lot of those scenarios today knocking on our door and say, we want to add, for instance, predictive maintenance or predictive servicing. So predictive servicing is you're selling trucks. So you're making trucks, and you're putting those trucks on the street. And you no longer sell the truck, but what you're selling is really the ability to get freight from A to B. That's the new business model. Everybody wants to go and add their services capabilities to their products. So the truck now needs to be highly available, and what you want to avoid is that the truck breaks down as it is driving from A to B. Because you're now providing, you're making assurances about the mobility. Maybe there's a part that's about to wear out. So what you need as a manufacturer who wants to offer that service, you need to have insight into how is that truck doing. Which means now you take effectively telemetry information, what we in IT know as log files, and you need to be able to push that out from the vehicle. And you need to go and collect this. And now you need to go and analyze and see which of the parts in that vehicle are potentially suspect and then need to be replaced. So that you can then go and react onto that telemetry and say, if there's a part that's suspicious, I'm going to reroute that truck to the next service station. And in the next service station, that part is going to be replaced and the truck can go back on its way. Information, live telemetry streamed from vehicles into analytics systems, which will then drive both the assignment of jobs to the service stations and then also drives notifications to the drivers to say, hey, you got to go and stop at that following station. Live telemetry. That's something that's not science fiction at all. That's in the concrete plans of numerous truck manufacturers. Very similar, connected car in passenger vehicles. We're going to see a great number of services. Fleet information systems, if you are a rental car company, or if you just have a lot of corporate vehicles, or fleet in terms of all the cars that the car manufacturer has put on the street, driver information systems, navigation, etc., and then all those servicing capabilities that I just talked about. One of the things that's most expensive in automotive, which you hear about very much, in unfortunate ways, is recall for the following type of vehicle. You hear this quite often, right? One of those recalls costs easily 200 million euros, a billion euros if it's really bad. And many of those things could be avoided if there was more data coming from the vehicle so that you could actually go and find which vehicles are suspect. For that, you need to have live telemetry. There's a problem here that is very interesting. A car manufacturer, think of a name, pick a big one, they put 1 million, 2 million, 3 million vehicles on the street per year. That car manufacturer, who we currently think about as an enterprise customer, as Microsoft and you, maybe has 300,000 employees. If you go and build an enterprise solution for 300,000 employees, that's something that is impressive now, these days, right? But of those 300,000 employees, a particular solution is maybe used by 10,000 people. Here, we're building systems 10 times the magnitude, or sorry, a magnitude higher than, than what the number of employees are. But all of those systems, all of those vehicles will not only be connected, they will be permanently connected. That scale challenge is much, much higher than any of the IT departments of those companies have ever done. Industrial automation. This is a showcase that we showed together with, that picture is of a showcase that we showed together with Krones. Krones AG is one of the largest, or it's the world leading manufacturer of beverage bottling machines and brewing equipment in the world. It's a German company. And about one third of all PET bottles that exist in the world are being filled by machines made by Krones. One great trend in industrial automation, it's called Industrial Internet in the US. In Germany, there's actually a government-led initiative called Industrie 4.0, Industry 4.0, that is actually having reach into a great number of other countries, where the goal is to make all of those machines interact. Today, the status mostly on the factory floor is that the machines that you have on the factory floor are barely talking to the outside world into what's called MES systems. The goal is that we can actually go and integrate those plants more globally, and that you can actually get global view over the manufacturing process. For instance, Contoso Bottling stands for some of the largest customers that Krones has, Heineken, Coca-Cola, etc. Those want to have global view of how their production process goes, and currently the data never leaves the factory, but they need to have a lot of data they need to go and collect. How does that work? How do you get that data out, and how do you collect it, and how do you relate to it, and how do you analysis over it? That's another big puzzle. Energy grid and natural resources. Natural resources, oil and gas exploration, and energy grid. We all try to get out of carbon fuels because we have to. And we also try to get out of the nuclear stuff because it's not the best idea. So renewable energies is probably a better idea, but renewable energies are not a steady source of power, and they're actually spread out in the country, right? A farmer sets up four of those poles and produces energy. Now, he becomes a power plant. The world of power management was actually very easy as long as the power companies had the monopoly of creating power. They had a number of power plants, and it was very easy for them to keep the grid in balance, because a power grid, voltage is tension. That power grid needs to be in balance. So if power gets in from solar cells and from wind energy, the power plants actually need to go and reduce their capacity. But that's all data driven. So you need to go and collect all that data. So the more of these renewable energies we get, the more problems it will have with data capture and data processing, and we need to do that at massive scale, at world scale, life scale, as I call it. Games, television, and consumer. The game Halo, depicted here, has been using Service Bus in version 4 to go and collect all the in-game information about your career. If you are a player of Halo, everything you've ever done in the game in the online games has been captured in a actor system, Project Orleans, and all the games has been captured. And as you explore your career on Halo Waypoint, you can actually get back into that history, and you can see the history of every single game you've ever played if you want to go and explore that. That's telemetry that's being captured, and that telemetry is also used to optimize the game experience. They're also using Halo, the team at 343 Studios, is also using telemetry to optimize the game and in testing. And so they want to go and build out more and more telemetry. Halo has a very interesting challenge, and every game title has an interesting challenge. All of the adoption curves that you have in a normal product is you start selling your product, and there's a slow ramp, right? You sell a few thousand per day, or maybe you sell a few 10,000 per day, but there's a relatively slow ramp. A game makes nearly all of its money in the first 5 days. So they go from zero to 2 million concurrent users within 24 hours. As quickly as people can get those DVDs or can get the downloads, as quickly that number ramps up. So their adoption curve looks like this, and then it tapers off. So they need to be ready on that day one, and they need to have effectively that ability and that scale to burst up so quickly and then go down. Television is very similar. We have numerous requests from television companies who say, hey, I have this show, reality TV casting show with music or nice ladies, models, Germany's Next Top Model, and I don't know who else is throwing on shows like this. And they want to have audience participation. Very simple principle, right? You make an app, and then you put on the screen, push the following buttons, who do you want to vote for? You show that on the screen, and then everybody pushes that button within 10 seconds. Well, you set up that infrastructure for those 10 seconds, and that's something that they find that's kind of hard. And also to tally up all the results, for that you need to have pretty awesome infrastructure. And that's a lot of infrastructure to stand up for 3 votes or 4 votes that you actually do in a show like this. So they find that that's enormously expensive. So all of these scenarios are very driven by scale, what we call hyperscale. This is 100, the squares. There's 10,000, with the 100 being in the one square, and 1 million is that. I couldn't actually fit this. A PowerPoint would murder me if I would try to make 1 million squares in it. 1 million is a lot. And 1 million is just a fraction of what you will see in those scenarios. 1 million sources of events. So our job that we set ourselves is, how do we deal with that? How do we create a thing that can actually deal with 1 million sources concurrently, which each drive a message per second into the system? What we came up with is Event Hubs. So Azure Event Hubs is a capability that sits inside of Service Bus that will allow you to go and ingest enormous amounts of data very, very quickly. You can bring more than 1 million producers, and you can actually have more than 1 gigabyte per second in aggregate throughput into an Event Hub. So basically, what we're currently seeing in terms of scenarios, and of course, this is just for one Event Hub. You can make more if you like to. So for most of the scenarios that we see for high-scale ingest, that's the optimal choice. I'm going to go through a lot of details on this. But as an overview, one thing that we do here is we have a highly partitioned system that gives you a lot of parallelism. I'm going to explain to you what that means when we go and get to consumers and consumer groups and to partitions. And we have a separate concept called throughput units. A throughput unit is a thing you can buy and that we charge by the hour, and that actually defines how much quota we give you to push events through. If you're a television show, you can go in with that. You can set up the system in a optimally partitioned way, but you can only drive up the throughput units for the time when you need it, and then you can dial that back down. That's something that's different than some services that the competitors may be offering, which have effectively a fixed relationship, questions at the end, please, which have a fixed relationships between partition count and cost. Here, partitions are something that you don't pay for, but you actually pay for the throughput, and that's something that is variable. Retention is another thing, but we're going to get to that. The way how you can go and send messages in is through the HTTP, actually HTTPS and AMQP protocols, and you can go get the messages also out through AMQP. So much as an overview, and now we're going to go more into details, and I will obviously also show you everything in action. Before we get into the details, a quick excursion on AMQP. AMQP is the Advanced Message Queuing Protocol 1.0. It's an effort that was actually started by not a technology company, but by JP Morgan Chase and a number of other Wall Street firms. And those Wall Street firms felt a little locked in into the stack that they were using. And there's some other companies which are building messaging systems, and they are keeping their interfaces proprietary. And so the bank says, that's something we can't live with. We can't live with that lock-in. We need to get out. And so they started this initiative to create an open protocol for reliable messaging that could supplant all those proprietary protocols. We have eventually, we got wind of that initiative. We liked that very much and then joined this and helped driving this to what it is now, the ISO standard 19464. So it is a ISO standard a protocol also by driven through OASIS into ISO standardization. And that is the choice, that is the default protocol that we run on with Service Bus. What it gives you is bidirectional, reliable, multiplexed message transfer with a very clever model of doing flow control, which we're leveraging for event hubs, as I'll explain to you. And it has a built-in type system that is optimized for business use. So you can think of it like structurally like JSON, maps, arrays, and values, but it has a better type system because JSON is actually weak in on the number type, and the date is not so well defined. So there's a number of things which are in JSON a little bit weird because it wasn't meant for that, right? It's JavaScript, and so it wasn't meant to be a business type system. So AMQP has the same layout structurally, but it has a better type system. And that's something that the AMQP encoding shares with a number of alternate versions, like Bison from MongoDB also has a better type system, but AMQP has a built-in one for that purpose. A clever thing, and that's something that we use here, is the flow control model. If you're a receiver, you're effectively parking link credit on the other side. So you don't say receive. You actually go and park link credit on this side and say, hey, I want to have 5 messages. And as messages arrive, become available, they are delivered over to B, and then that's being deducted from the link credit, which means you can go and with this model both classic one-by-one receive, as well as effectively unlimited receive streams, which is something that we leverage for event hubs to make that protocol very, very efficient. So AMQP multiplexed capability. You can have one connection and then have bidirectional streams over it that are independent. And you have this link credit model, which allows you for very efficient management. That's why we like it. There's also a standard proposal at this point, which we're also implementing, AMQP over WebSockets. And that protocol will allow you to also tunnel all this through port 443. So on Event Hubs, we have two models for send and receive. So actually, we have the existing models for send and receive, really, for that are in line with what we do in Service Bus. So if you have an application that can send to Service Bus today, you can already send to Event Hubs. So we keep all of this completely symmetric. So you can use a message sender But you can also use a simpler programming model that's specific to this called the EventHub client with event data. And the AMQP protocol and the HTTPS protocol, the surface area, is effectively the same. So if you know how to send messages to Service Bus, you know how to send messages to EventHub. The security model is also consistent with the rest of Service Bus, with some additions that I'm going to get to in, as I talk about publishers specifically. And then the receiver side accommodates partition consumption with failover and leader elections. That's a little, if you're not too deep into distributed systems, leader election may be something that's a little computer science-y. So I will actually show you what that, how that happens in the demo. And we're using AMQP, an AMQP 1.0 consumer model, how you can go and pull those messages out. The big difference, so far, Event Hubs is just like Service Bus as you might know it. The big difference on the receiver side is that the client manages the cursor. What does that mean? With a normal queue, you walk up to, the queue is built over a log. And the receiver walks up and wants to get a message. With that, you move the cursor over that log one more, and that message has been consumed. That message will never show up again for anybody. Because that cursor is on the queue, or is on the subscription, and whoever pulls from it moves that cursor once ahead. Event hubs are different because event hubs allow you to pick where that cursor starts and keep track of the cursor yourself. So the sender side looks like a queue. The receive side looks like a database. Because you can pick by point in time when you want to go back, and we can retain that data, and you can use this as an event store. If you have heard that term before. We'll get more into that. Let's talk about partitions first, because they matter. So partitions allow you to segment the event stream either for higher parallelism and higher throughput. You can have, and this is related also to the throughput units. So I'm going to get to that as I talk about throughput units, what that means in terms of throughput. But you can have at most one throughput unit per partition. So if you want to have maximum throughput, you will need to have a lot of partitions. So that's a, it's, at one, it's a scale thing. Second, in most systems that are operating at that scale, if you think about really millions of vehicles or millions of anything, you will have to go and partition up the backend systems that sit behind this, right? So you might have, depending on what database technology you use or which data processing technology you use, you may have to go and slice up the backend systems, and you may have to go and have different databases behind it. The partitioning model that we have has various, we give you various options for either controlling that yourself, so you can effectively send directly to a particular partition, or we can go and effectively do that hashing for you. And then we can also manage how you pull stuff from the Event Hub and deal with all the partitioning magic for you, or you can do that explicitly. So for instance, if you simply want to have a huge pipe, if that's what your goal is, and you basically just push stuff in, and then you pull it out, and you put it all into the same store, let's say into Blob Store, we can accommodate this. If you want to send in with a big pipe from a million sources, but then you want to go and have 32 distinct processing pillars that you have in your system, we can accommodate that too. So either one big road with many lanes, or actually one big road where you have many forks at the end of it. So the default is 16. If you just basically do a quick create, you get 16 partitions. The minimum is 8. So it's a partitions are something that we force on you. And the self-service maximum is 32. So that's what you can do in the portal. Because what we want to avoid, and this is why we have the self-service maximum, is we want to avoid that you make 100,000 partitions, right? Because that's not what it's for. It's not so that you can have a partition per device, but it's something that you will do to get kind of very chunky separation of data in your system. But if you call Azure support and open a support ticket and give a good reason, which we will review, and that's how this works, right? There's a number of features you can enable by calling Azure support. And the way that works is the support people come to us and say, here's why they want to do this. And then we may actually go and get on the phone with you and say, yeah, maybe we're going to do this, and maybe not. But that's something that we have to go and then debate. Because usually, when you go over the limits that we set, there's reason to talk. But we're willing to accommodate it. And so we can enable up to 1024, and in special cases, even more partitions. You can have at most 10 of these event hubs on a per namespace basis. I'll talk a bit more about the partition use and how you can do and send them as I talk about the center specifically. The throughput units map to those partitions in that you can have at most one of those throughput units per partition. If you have 1,000 partitions, you can have 1,000 throughput units. That's how we get to that 1 gigabyte. So for write, you get 1 megabyte per second or 1,000 message operations. We're going to get to the pricing later. I'll tell you that. And for read, 2 megabytes per second. And the retention that's included with the throughput unit is 84 gigabytes per day, which means if you push hard for 24 hours, that's what you end up with. So with each throughput unit, that's included. The overage over 84 gigabytes is charged at locally replicated storage cost. So it's actually not too much of a big deal. The retention can be expanded with self-service to up to 7 days. And if you call us, we can expand that to up to 30 days. So if you want to keep this, if you want to use it as an event store, you can use it as an event store to keep raw data. Typically, in most scenarios that you will find, you will eventually go and checkpoint your raw data anyways and roll it up. And so data retention for all time is usually not a good choice. So if you believe in, for instance, event sourcing and models like CQRS, where you can go and build projections out of this, that is the most scalable event store that you will find. But retention is limited to 30 days, right? So you would have to go and checkpoint after that because we don't want to make a forever database, also because that's usually architecturally crazy. If you have 10 partitions and you have 10 throughput units, you get 10 megabytes. The math is very easy. You apply these throughput units on the namespace level. You can do that through API. Or you can also do it through the portal, so you can slide it up and slide it down, and that's how you get those, and they're charged by the hour. You can have at most 20 of those throughput units in self-service, and if you call us, then we can give you many, 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 many more. So, publishers. Publishers are the senders which are sending into the system. As I said, we have two protocols that we're currently supporting. There's HTTPS, and HTTPS, some people say the REST interface. I like HTTP interface much better. So through HTTPS, if you have relatively low throughput and if you show up very rarely, so if you only from a particular client only send a message, once per 10 minutes or once per minute or once per day, then HTTPS is maybe the better protocol. Because it's simpler, it doesn't require an MQP stack. As soon as you get kind of higher up in speed and need to have lower latency and are sending requests more frequently, MQP quickly turns into the better protocol because it's more efficient and also more reliable. The tiebreaker for you might be that MQP connections that are retained become billable. They're not expensive. You're going to see that on this price sheet, but they're billable. And HTTPS requests and the keep alive sockets are not, because we can cut them at any point in time. The publishers can publish to explicitly to the partition ID. So You can target exactly the partition you want to go to. There's this particular API, and there's equivalent MQP gesture and also an HTTP gesture you can use, so you can go and directly target a particular partition ID. So if you want to take your the partitioning into your own hands completely, you're free to do it. You can also set the partition key. Partition key is a property that's being included in the message that you send. And what we do is we will go and hash on that partition key and then put that into a map, into a matching partition. And that is a stable hash function, which means that calculation always gets the same result. So effectively, we do that for you. If you don't give any of this, then we will effectively do a round-robin random distribution of those messages across all those partitions. Another way of doing this is to use the publisher policy, which is a brand new construct in Service Bus, and which you will see popping up in more places. A publisher policy lives to, effectively on the path, if you will, on the right side of the address of the entity. So Service Bus slash Event Hub slash publisher slash name. So you can go and send to that particular destination. The publisher policy serves two purposes. The first one is its security mechanism, because you can selectively block those publishers. And what you can do is you can go and make a security token, a shared access token, that you assign and you issue specifically for that publisher policy, so just for that path. And giving a client that token, which you can make long-lived, will give that client specifically only a right to send to that one place. So if you have a million senders, it would be fairly foolish to give every single one of them rights to send across that whole thing. So what you're doing here is you're creating a token, and that token is now scoped to that one name, and they can only send to this. What that causes is that we will now infer the partition key from that name. So that name goes into the partition key, which now actually creates a security tie-in where we can now say, only a bearer of a token for that name can have sent into this, and that's what we're noting down in the message. So on this, on the receive side, you can be sure that that partition key represents actually the owner of that particular publisher policy. The number of publisher policies you can go and create is, because they're not created physically in the system, is unlimited. And then we have a mechanism in the system that allows you to block them. So if you have given someone a token and you want to revoke the right, you can do that server side. Right? And the other thing you also have are able to do is of obviously also to make the token time constrained, but you have all the flexibility and all those options here. So publishers can selectively go to the partition ID, or they can go to the partition key, and then also use these publisher policies. And the publisher policies will actually get some more intelligence over time, like throttling on a per sender basis. Consuming out of Event Hub, you do with a consumer group. The consumer group effectively gives you a view over that Event Hub. A consumer group is conceptually similar to a topic subscription. So you go and the receivers read through that consumer group. And again, that's something that's a feature with runway, so as I always say. So there's future things we can go and anchor on that on that construct. Right now, it's a grouping construct, and that also allows you to constrain how many readers you can have on the system. It's also an anchor for checkpointing. We're going to talk about that in a moment. And you can have up to 20 of these consumer groups, which can read concurrently. On each partition, you can only have one receiver on a consumer group. So you make a consumer group, and then you can have only one receiver on that particular partition from that in that consumer group. A consumer, right, receives through the consumer group. In the .NET API, you have a the consumer group makes the receiver. And you can use the .NET API, as I just said, or you can use any generic AMQP one client. We are working very closely with the Apache Cupid Proton team that gives us effectively coverage for any language under the sun. They have implementations for C. They have implementations for Java. They have an upcoming implementation for JavaScript. for the AMQP protocol, and we're actually actively contributing into that, and we're working also with other companies to build embedded versions of this. So that's something that we are working to kind of broaden the base of supported clients and platforms. And for the C API, there's actually bindings for Python and for PHP and for other clients to be able to go and consume that. The cursors, so that's the how you actually get into that stream, how you start reading into that stream, are based on either an ID or a timestamp. So the ID is effectively just a counter on the log, so you can keep track of that. Or you can say, I want to have all the events since this time. So if you have multiple event hubs, for instance, which you can have, and you need to do synchronization over time, you can go to both event hubs on the same partition that correlates, and then you can go and sync them all up and read those streams in, which is something that's interesting if you want to do correlated stream event processing. We also have direct support for external leader election models with epochs. I'm going to explain that as we get into the demo, because that'll be a little easier to show with the demo that we have. So the distributed system support here is realized through a set of extensions. So on the consumer side, you have a lot of concurrent receivers, and those concurrent receivers, you can only have one receiver per consumer group, per partition. So if you have a lot of receivers that are sitting on multiple machines, you have to go and coordinate this. We have a built-in thing called the event processor host, which we ship with the system. But we also have a built-in model in the .NET API specifically, how you can go and fit any other leader election mechanism. And so you will see those things that are listed here. They're for reference. You will see that live kind of along with the event processor host as I showed the demos, which I'm going to do now. So let us see. I'm doing mighty good on time. Oh, well, that's going to be fun. Now my daughter is on video. Here we go. So I'm going to start this little demo now. I'm going to be nervous because my machine actually fell asleep, amazingly. Well, let's go and start this. Let's see whether that works. Okay, it did work. So what's happening here is I have a backend set. I have a setup here where I have four machines, which are mid-size worker role VMs, and they are pulling on Event Hub, and that Event Hub is preloaded. So we're using the capability inside of Event Hub to retain events. So this is going into a reloaded one, and what it's now doing is it's using this event processor host, and it's using the partitioning system to gain ownership of these partitions. So now you're seeing one machine, and the one machine is going through, and this event processor host now gives effectively every partition a little time slice to go and pull messages off. The messages are being pulled in. You only get to see a message here for every 10,000 messages. So you get a calculation of the messages per second, but over a 10,000 message window, so that's why it takes a little bit of time here for things to show up. But now that machine is all owning all those partitions. That's something we do here, so that this machine, right, will now own all the partitions, and all except for two will actually get messages eventually. So we'll wait another 20 seconds for more things to show up. And of course, the partitioning mechanism here happens, I have used the partition key. So that distribution is happening over that hash, so not all the events are actually evenly distributed. So it takes, for some partitions, it takes a little bit longer time to get to 10,000 messages. But they're kind of filling up here a little bit. And we're getting like 500 messages per second, and that's because this receiver, which I'm going to show you the code of, goes and rotates through all those partitions to get some messages from a few. And mind, this is for super high-scale throughput. That's a scary message. I successfully logged into the following hotspot net. I don't want to log into a hotspot network. That's amazing. Okay, well, there's still messages flowing, so I'm not going to be nervous. Now I'm going to start the next guy. See what's happening? This is a different machine that I just started on the back end. So now that machine is actually stealing partitions away from the other guy. And you also see that that throughput is instantly going up because now it's servicing fewer partitions and it gets higher throughput automatically. So we're now kind of already up to 6,800. So I'm now going to start the other guys. This one and that one. And soon enough, they're now going to start stealing partitions from the other guys, and we're getting higher throughput. And because we're using large windows, and we're using large windows because this is a JavaScript client, and that JavaScript client's actually getting all those messages now pumped up, and this sits in US Central. So I don't have high resolution, so that's not exact science math here. But we're getting pretty significant throughput here pulled in. And every one of those machines here only maintains a single socket into Event Hub. And we're getting here processing rates of 8,000, and it's still rising, 9,000. It'll go up to about 12,000, 13,000 messages per second that it's pulling in from Event Hub. And obviously, I can also push messages in. I left that out because of the bandwidth that I have here. I wouldn't be able to go and see the message that would be backed up. But you get very automatic distribution of the consumers. And there's a lot of distributed systems magic that happens here. So I'm going to shed some light on that. Let's go and take a look at that code and how hard it is to go and do that sort of processing. And I have that here. So this is the sample. And we have effectively two. We have this processor, this event processor. So let's go and we have a sender and a receiver. That's what I want to say. So we're going to go into this worker role and see what's happening as it starts up. So there's some work that happens here to go and set up our control management. So this is all based on queues. By the way, this is also a great example. What we're showing here, this JavaScript application is actually built on top of Service Bus. So all the messages that are flowing are coming through Service Bus, and we're pulling the queues directly. So there's not Signal R here, but it's actually coming through Service Bus. And when there is a control message that says start here, that's in process message, go to implementation. What we do here is we start the event processor host or we stop the event processor host. So let's go and see what happens when we start it. Okay, so the event processor host is something we set up with a number of parameters. We set it up with a name, and we're using the machine name here for this, with the name of the event hub, that's the entity that's in here. The group name, so that's the consumer group name, and you can either define your own or you can use the default group, and which we use here. Then the connection string for the security setup, and then a blob connection string, which is a very interesting thing that I'm going to get to in a second. And then to start this event processor host, you go and register an event processor with it. The event processor, the IAM event processor interface, is part of the Service Bus core SDK that's in the Service Bus assembly directly, while the event processor host is separate. So let's go and take a look at the NuGet dependencies here for this project, just to illustrate this. You see that there's the Service Bus assembly that contains the core API for event hubs, and then there's this event processor host, that's the abstraction that I'm showing you right now. It's just the host. And I'll explain to you in a second what that host does. So, but this registration function is actually something that's being passed through to the core API. That event hub processor here. Why did that go to LinkedIn? Amazing. here is that class that you implement. This is your code, effectively. And what you need to implement are functions that are open, close, and process events effectively. And what you get is, based on the options that you provide, a partition context that contains the information about which partition you're about to process from, and a collection of messages. And how big that batch is depends on what the upper bound is that you define. What I'm doing here is I'm taking the messages out. The messages are expressed as event data, and now I'm processing them. And what I'm doing in this particular example is I'm processing, I'm rolling them up, and then I send a little message to that dashboard. What you would usually do in one of those event processors is you would go and write them to the database, or you would roll them up. Or in the case of the stream analytics, here, this is the brand new stream analytics capability that we have in Azure. Stream analytics is also using actually the exact same mechanism to pull messages out of Event Hub in a very similar way, using those same capabilities. You have these inputs here. I actually have two data streams. You can put a query in here that says, I get data from one event stream, and I get data from another event stream. I can go and correlate that, and then go and produce another event stream, which I can then push into, for instance, another event hub. So that's the stream analytics service actually takes a direct dependency on event hubs and pulls stuff through. You can analyze it right there with a SQL-like query, and then push it further into another event hub. And it automatically kind of wires all those things up. That's a fabulous thing. So that's something that you can also do with this. It's like the way how they're wiring this up is they're wiring this up exactly as you would do it here with your own code. So that's a very simple API. And what that API does is makes you not worry about any of that partition stuff. So let me take a look again. Let us take a look again at that picture. And then let's reason about for a second why I need that blob connection string. What is that good for? So in our platform, in the base platform of Azure, we have some pretty amazing computer science work that you're going to see in the next 12 months, I would say. We have some nice ways of implementing this leader election model that you see here. Also in other ways, and that's something that we're actually practicing here in this event processor host, which is pretty clever. A leader election means that for a given partition, you're choosing who's the boss of that partition. That's a leader election. So as you are adding or removing processors, right, for a particular partition, you need to force a decision on who the owner is. And there's many ways of doing this in distributed systems. There's things like DHT, distributed hash tables. There's consensus protocols. There's all kinds of ways of how we can go and do this. Here we have a fairly pedestrian but very efficient way of doing this because we have a leader election mechanism kind of built into the platform already. It's based on blobs. So what the system here does is it creates a little blob for each of these partitions and then it puts a lease on it. A lease means how long are you using that partition? How long can you use that partition exclusively? And that's a feature that has been implemented for VMs, for instance, right? VMs it's a blob that you're storing your data on. And so you need to have a mechanism that allows you to exclusively put a lock on those things. What you can also do with these blob leases is you can break it. So the blob leases get renewed, and you must renew them to retain them. But you can, someone from the outside can come and say, break this lease, which means the owner can no longer release it, but it actually needs to reacquire it. So reacquisition is something new. So what this system here does is effectively sets up these blobs, and now the leases get renewed, and as soon as a new guy comes up, he says, break all the leases that exist and forces an election on that whole partition set. And that's how leader election is done here. And that's why we need to have that blob connection string for the event processor host. So we're doing leader election here to have that parallelism. So, and that's something that is working. That's work that we're doing for you. You don't need to worry about it. You just use that one assembly. If you have your own mechanism of doing this, If you're using ZooKeeper, and that's something that we use, for instance, in Apache Storm, we are actually integrating with ZooKeeper. If you have any other mechanism to do the leader election, then you can go and do this yourself. In the receivers, and this is the way how we implement this, the blobs have actually nothing to do with event hubs, right? The blobs is just a coordination mechanism that event processor host uses. What it then causes is there is a number stored in that blob, what's called an epoch. And that epoch is just incremented. It's a number that's being incremented. When you show up with an epoch, as you create a receiver, whoever has the highest epoch wins on the server, which means everybody who has a lower epoch gets disconnected, which means if there's an existing receiver, someone else shows up with a higher epoch, that existing receiver gets disconnected. That's how you're actually forcing the leader election outcome on the system. If you don't provide an epoch, so just leave that off, you leave that null, that's a nullable integer, then you can have up to 5 receivers concurrently on a single consumer group, on a single partition. Otherwise, we're forcing one receiver to make sure you have that sort of parallelism. That is all set up so that you can have, with great confidence, right, multiple and however many receivers and processors on that event hub, you know, up to over 1,000 partitions, where it's clear who owns which partition, because that's really important for all of these use cases. So that's pulling, right, from these systems. Let's go and take a look at some simpler things. We have on the portal, where are we? So here, in the documentation, we have a bunch of samples. You can go and get to those samples. They're in code on msdn.com. So I'm going to show you some of those samples. Since I'm introducing this for the first time, I just showed you a fancy demo. Now I'm going to get a little bit more boring. And I'm just going to show you a few samples, because the reason why we have the samples is they're there to learn. So I just want to go and show them to you quickly. So one of those is the very simple getting started sample. And is that also the getting started sample? Hang on. That is the getting started sample. And the getting started sample shows you effectively here all the various forms of how you can go and manage it. So you create a namespace manager. I'm sticking with the .NET API here today. You can go and do all those things also through Java. You can do them through C. You can do them through PHP, because all of the foundation of all this is our HTTP API. So I'm just showing you here, for better illustration, the happy, pretty .NET API. So we have namespace manager. Namespace manager, through that, you can go and create an event hub, specifying a name, specifying a number of partitions. Once you've done this, you get an event hub. Let's go and take a look here at my portal. Service bus is right here. So that's my EU namespace. Here are my event hubs that I have here. And creating an event hub is very easy. You basically just go new and quick create in the portal. So I have some here. That's my demo, my personal demo event hub. And here you can go and configure how long the messages are being retained, whether that's on or off. You can't change the number of partitions after creating, which is logical, because the partition key function will go and distribute it into the various partitions. If I would change that, then that would go and skew. So I have to keep that stable. And here you can also define the shared access policies. At the namespace level, so right here, I can go and configure, not this, but that. I can configure the scale. So that's the throughput units that I can set on that namespace. This is how this looks in the self-service version. And then I have this very funky namespace here, IoT event hub /ns. And you see there's no slider here. This is how this looks when I have called in and say, hey, I need to have a little bit more. So This now has 200 throughput units, which means I can push 200 megabytes per second through that event hub when that's set up that way, which means also logically that this thing has 200 partitions. So let's go back at the sample. So you create a normal, you can go and create a receiver. That's an abstraction that we built here in that implementation. The receiver gets an event hub, creates an event hub client. The event hub client is created from the connection string. So if you're familiar with the Service Bus API, it basically just looks all the same. It's all the same patterns that we use. You create the event processor host, as you just saw. So that's all explained in that getting started sample. And if you want to go and send, you send, so you create a sender and an event hub client. You go and then create these the little events. What you see here is that we are actually putting JSON into the event data. So the event data here is basically just a bag of bytes. You see we're making here this the data. We're serializing that as JSON, and we're putting that event data also into the message as a bag of bytes, just a byte array. That's something that for downstream processing, there's an assumption here in this case that that's JSON data. And that's an assumption that's actually true for if you're composing with, let's say, Stream Analytics. Stream Analytics supports three formats. It supports CSV, comma-separated values. They support JSON, and they support Apache Avro. And Avro is a tagged format that's very efficient, has a leading effectively schema that is in the package. And whatever you want to flow, whatever format and encoding you want to flow, you can basically go and put that in here. So whether you like protobuf, whether you like bson, whether you like ubjson, whatever the current fashion of encoding formats is, you can go in and stick that in here. And the AMQP, equivalent AMQP gesture is AMQP proton gesture, let's say in C, is also put that into the AMQP message. So it's a very simple, that's a very, very simple model for how to go and send the data in to get the data out. And then you've seen the event processor already. So the samples will go and show you this. The samples will also show you how to send directly to a service bus entity. And what I also want to show you is if you are across platform, and I didn't want to go and expose you all to all the details. Well, so this is something where Chrome is actually not so good at. So I will show you that in a real browser. Because that I could scale without it messing it up. We have some tutorials here, which we built for a combination of things. It's actually quite nice. So you have the platform for the client, C# or Java or C. And that's going to be a grown collection, and then the backend is Apache Storm or Event Processor, and we have these tutorial for all the combinations of those. So let's go and take a look at the Event Processor. You already saw that how that works. So let's go and take a look at the C version of this. So you create an Event Hub, and then it also tells you. Let's go, scroll down. So how do you get on Linux, in this case, how do you get access to Cupid Proton? Cupid Proton being that library. On Windows, you have to go and effectively attach to either the Git repository that sits in GitHub for Apache, that's a copy, or the SVN repository, download the code, and then they have step-by-step instructions of how to build it on Windows, so you can build that on Windows as well. But here we have it on Linux, because most people who are using the C library, as we find out, are using it on Linux or embedded Linux. Very many on embedded Linux, because embedded Linux has great popularity in the Internet of Things as a platform. So that's why we have these instructions here. And then you basically you can write a little program, and that little program is actually not hard. And here's how sending a message works in Proton. I'm just going to make it a little bit bigger. So you make a message, you set the address, and the address is the address of the event hub, AMQP host, and the path. You set the the content type, and then you basically start the message body, and just as you had in the C# program, you basically set the binary message body, and you set that to what the message text is. So that's the exact equivalent code to what you just saw on in C#, which you can now run into almost any embedded platform. There's some limits right now that we see in the AMQP C client if you go down to very, very tiny devices, and that's something that we're actually actively working on and also plan to contribute back into Qubit Proton work that is running this on the tiniest possible devices that have enough capacity to at least fulfill the security requirements. That's the baseline, effectively, for AMQP or for actually secure internet communication. So the baseline hurdle for all that communication for those embedded devices is to being able to support TLS, transport level security. And we're also doing active work on that to make transport level security less of a burden for those tiny little devices. And that's something that we're going to talk about next year. So you have the examples here that actually shows you how to do this all in C. And then we also have, if you are Java and you're doing Apache Storm, there's a whole tutorial here for how to have a full Java client, the Java client with build instructions. The Java client is using it's using JMS. And then we're also showing you how to go and pull this all into Apache Storm. Apache Storm is an analytics platform. It's similar to what we have now in Stream Analytics, but you can go and extend it with code. And that's something that's very popular. It's also, we have a Storm implementation now in HD Insight that you can leverage. And actually, the client code here, that spout that it's called, comes from the HD Insight implementation, the HD Insight Storm installation. There's how you actually can get at that code. So cross-platform is real, right? We believe, since from the very beginning, from my talk, if you have events that are coming out of everyday objects, right, out of cars and out of kitchen appliances and whatever they are, there's a whole big world of real-time OSs and Linux and various flavors of Linux and Windows, obviously, too. Windows is very big in industrial automation that is there, then produces events. So we try to get as much coverage as we can from the client side. We also realize that there's a lot of really cool stuff that sits out in there in the open source world and over on Linux and on Java, also in proprietary form, that needs that kind of high-scale processing. So we're trying to accommodate from the client side as well as the receiver side kind of every model you can imagine. I showed you in the code example mostly the C# versions, but you can also find that in the documentation in more detail, how you can go and process from all those things in and from other platforms. So, what is the price? These are the prices as per release. We put the bits into the data center on Friday. So the service is now generally available. It's production ready. You can use it now. We had a preview period of like 3 months, but this is now production ready. You can use it. The throughput unit per hour, we have two tiers. The basic tier is up to 100 connections, and there is no extension whatsoever. It's effectively the super low cost tier. That you can use to go and try things out. Or if you have a very, very small installation, or if you want to run this as a hobby project, then you're paying a little more than, 1.5 cents US dollars, so a euro cent, roughly, used to be. Close. I have the old exchange rate in my head. We are not doing as well against the dollar anymore. So a little bit more than a euro cent per hour, and you can go and dial those things up or down, right? I'm paying with 200 throughput units I have configured on my that one namespace. I'm paying $2 per hour. That is actually not too bad. And then in standard, you can get up to 1,000 connections per throughput unit. So that's significantly more. They're included, and standard, you can actually go and extend. So standard is actually the standard model that we think is the one for any commercial use. And for that, you have 3 US dollar cents. Ingress events, roughly 3 cents per, 0.028 per million events. An event is a message as it comes into the system up to 64K. And then the broker connections that we maintain are these micro dollars per hour. They run up, this all rounds up to a few cents per month each. That charge exists because we believe that in very many scenarios, these connections will be stable. And that customers will try to maintain those connections for a very, very long time. And this is something that's a forward-looking model. Because we believe that that connection is not only valuable for pushing data down, but since we're supporting multiplexing on AMQP, it's also interesting for pulling data up. And what we see is that in very many IoT scenarios, you not only do telemetry, but you also do something with the telemetry that you gain, and you want to do some control functions. So what you can also do is, on that same connection, you can actually go and pull messages from a subscription. And this is why it's actually very useful to have all those capabilities sitting in the same namespace, and that's why service bus is a single thing, because you can go and combine those entities. So you can make a topic that has a subscription, and you can combine those topics into trees where you can have a subscription per device. And you can go and pull those messages, and you can send those messages and pull those messages through the same, very same connection. And that's why if you need to have persistent connectivity, if you want to have effectively the ability to go and push messages up to a device, you need to maintain that socket, and that's why we have that per socket charge. Because we expect that people specifically, so that customers in automotive, but also in home automation and in many other scenarios, will want to keep those stable connections alive. So we have a charge here that reflects that in pricing. The storage overage is cheap. It's basically locally redundant Azure storage charged through, so that's a few cents per month for extra storage. So it's overall, I think the pricing, what we find is that if you do, if you add up the dollars for serious commercial scenarios, you will find that it still adds up to an interesting number, but that interesting number will be much, much, much lower to any infrastructure you have to go and stand up and maintain yourself to go and do something of similar capacity. Setting that up the capacity specifically for bursty traffic is really, really hard, and also doing all that work to go and coordinate is really, really hard. And there is, factually, if you go around, there's not a lot of infrastructure which can go and do that with the same throughput and with the same reliability. And we're actually very comfortable with competition, and we're very comfortable with looking at what our competitors can do in terms of reliability, in terms of throughput, when you compare those things. So, summary. Massive scale. Event ingestion into the cloud. It's cloud only for the time being. That doesn't mean it will never come onto on-premises, but that will take a while. And we believe that this is much, much easier than anything you can find on the market comparatively. Specifically for the .NET developers, super easy. Because we provide that event processor host. Also for Java developers, it's super easy because we provide the Apache Storm Spout. From a programming model perspective, it's pretty revolutionary. And gives you capability in terms of event ingestion for a broad number of scenarios that were so far impossible. Let me just note one more thing. It is fabulous for logs. I talked about all these Internet of Things scenarios. That's kind of the picture I painted in your head. If you think about logging in systems that you have today, right, and putting stuff into blobs and then loading all the blobs and looking those through, if you think about what you can do in your existing systems kind of from an operational side, this is ideal because it can keep a memory for however long you care, and you don't care for more than 30 days. For operational logs that you want to get to. But you want to go and sync on time. You want to say, hey, this happened last week on Friday at this time. Let's go and get the sliver of events, and let's go and take a look at them. So not only for all those scenarios, but really also for scenarios that have that you currently you have in IT, logging, diagnostics, auditing, anything that is really driving events into a system, it's an optimal infrastructure, and it will scale up to the needs of the highest scale system, because this is going to be the fastest thing that sits behind your system. It's going to be the fast logging infrastructure that sits behind your system. And saying that, the internals of Azure are going to replumb on top of this because of it. So that's a foundational service where a lot of the internal services, not only from Azure, but also from other big Microsoft properties, will go and start replumbing on top of that Event Hub capability, because it is ideal, an ideal platform for those events. And if you're a fan of event sourcing kind of scenarios, it's also an ideal solution for that. More information is up on the Event Hub site that I showed you, and you can have it now. And we got more resources and more wonderfulness and all of this and that. And then it would be very nice if you would submit your evaluations so that I know how I'm doing. And otherwise, thank you very much, and I wish you a wonderful trip home, or enjoy the rest of the weekend if you're staying in Barcelona. Thank you for coming to TechEd.